This is a reading from Richard Rose's Albigen Papers, the fifth paper. Obstacles to Transcendental Efforts. The Trap of Conditioning. There are many obstacles to mental clarity, but the most insidious is mental conditioning. The voice of the appetites is louder, and its form wears little or no mask, but conditioning is subtle. Conditioning probably contributes more to the spiritual inertia of man than any other factor. Other minds have seen the adverse effects of conditioning. We can read Huxley's Brave New World, for example. Huxley seemed concerned more with the intellectual enslavement of man and the social results, but he depicts the man of the future as a conditioned zombie. It is bad enough that we are conditioned by nature to function as well-behaved potted plants in this terrestrial greenhouse. It is quite another thing when we start doing it to one another. We begin by conditioning our children to save them a few knocks in life. Teachers use about 50% of the classroom time in conditioning children for plasticity. This process is called citizenship training. Next, a good percentage of the young men will have to take military training, which process is designed to produce automatons to do any bidding, take any insult or degradation, and be convinced of individual worthlessness and individual inability. They are also trained to be proud of this treatment. Of course, men who are conditioned for the acts should not be burdened with too much thinking, but this is as tyrannical as expecting a rabbit that you are eating for dinner to provide napkins and gratitude. Lodge members condition other members with asinine initiations. Mankind is basically afraid of individualistic men. We do not like to face a brave, independent man nearly as well as a harmless, inoffensive one. We elect to office mostly people who avoid positive attitudes, and consequently, we rarely get men of principle. Businesses set up schools to brainwash candidates for sales and executive positions in order to have a minimum of trouble with the business organization. They are taught to handle people. What this actually means is that a sort of professional behavior pattern is adopted to which they want all people to conform, including both workers and clients. We are cast into a state of awe by the choice of words used by mere mechanics who are conniving for some justification for public support and for livelihood. One such word was the title doctor. But let us read the history of the Mayo brothers. A century ago, a doctor was reverenced almost the same as a priest, but now we find that they knew very little, took only a short course in medical training, and robbed graves by night to get cadavers. Yet they held their heads high by day and literally commanded respect. We have conditioned ourselves to accept excesses in government. We are stunned into silence by authority in uniform, in gown and gavel, and by the ruthless glint in the barrister's eye. And all of this happens for the benefit of nature, which scarcely needs any help in running this greenhouse. We are not becoming, as human beings, more compassionate and loving, or more filled with understanding for our fellow man. We are only becoming more docile and faceless out of compulsion. Everything possible is employed to grease the sloping path to the slaughterhouse, including theology. Such is the calloused efficiency of those who feel themselves called to take charge of the propaganda and literature of conditioning. Modern drama now depicts the mother betraying the son or the daughter betraying the parent for the meaningless codes of the state. At the turn of the century, this betrayal would have been considered an act so base as to invite the hate of all humanity. Now it is noble. No matter how well it is welded together, the social entity is no better than its individual parts. The expansion of the individual is, in the long run, for the betterment of the state. A shrinking of the individual has already in our time begun to show signs that lead to social chaos. States of perception. I have noticed that all or most psychologists or claimants to authority on matters psychic carefully minimize the difference in states of perception, or else write or speak as though every reader should be compelled to interpret their words in one incontrovertible way. All the while, most of the difficulties in the social world are the result of differences of mental states and the complete failure to understand the other fellow's state. Marital incompatibilities, both mental and the mentally inspired physical ones, come as a result of different mental states. Factional conflicts likewise have the same roots, whether they be of religious, political, or ethnic nature. Let us look at the different states of perception. I am sure that when a person understands the wide range of perception states and mental states, he will begin to wonder if the human mind will ever be able to discern among these many states that singular state that might be called sanity. States of perception, in turn, affect states of mind. They are not the same. The former involves qualified means of seeing or perceiving. The latter involve periods of conviction marked by related attitudes. States of perception are those states that may be produced by sensory imperfections, drugs, chemicals, or other conditions. Anyone who has gone through an alcoholic experience will know that a few ounces of alcohol will change the world's aspect for the user. That which is perceived is a new state of perceiving. The new aspect may be so different that it shakes the validity of prior states that which we identify with convention and sanity. The drinker may find the new ensuing state of mind and not be aware that it is caused by an abrupt change in his perceiving apparatus. States of perception are generally of short duration, and while they may trigger or reawaken states of mind, they are more factors of coloration than lasting states of conviction. Subliminal states of consciousness are perceptions of longer duration and of greater intensity, and they have the ability to dominate the entire perspective or perception field. More will be said of them later. To give a further explanation of this mental vacillation, inaccurate states of perception, let us look through the romantic eyes of younger days when a particular mood descended upon us at sunset or sunrise, upon entering a cave, upon watching lightning. Now, these are outstanding incidents which may have changed our mood, if not our mind, momentarily, and which left strong memories behind. Examining the possible causes of these states of perception may help us to be more aware of their influence. The sunrise seems to fill us with awe and vigor, even though our training tells us that we are probably only experiencing a combination of the quiet hush and the slow-changing light and color patterns. It may be that that which occurs is the remembering of a primordial urge to go forth in search of food. Also, dawn usually comes when a person is rested and when there are no pressing worries on the mind. The mind has rubbed out the worries in the forgetfulness of sleep. So now the mind and the eye have time to dawdle as the mind of a child upon such things that are momentarily new. We now have a combination of rememberings that are not conscious memories. We have a combination of vigor, a carefree mind, and an infantile pleasantness, along with the hypnotically changing panorama of dawn. And even after reading and believing this paragraph, if we walked in the meadow at dawn, we would still feel the awe, and the mystery would momentarily put our philosophic attitude to the test. Our daily life is a concatenation of changing moods, some diametrically opposite to the predecessor of an hour. We are hypnotized by objects and by other people. Some of the spells are short-lived, harmless little excursions into a fragrant flower or a poem. But the concatenation literally becomes a chain, and our years are bound in chains that resulted from the hypnosis of a few moments that caused us to make decisions that tied up our direction for decades of our short life. Some of the results of such hypnosis or attitude compulsions are marriage or mating, murder, enlistment in organizations, and the development of habits that cannot be abandoned. You may say, oh yes, we know all about the traps, while uttering the words from the midst of several traps that have been nobly rationalized. But unless we are constantly conscious of ourselves in each reaction to the environment, we will succumb. And I doubt, in all sincerity, that even a select dedicated group of men could free themselves completely. They could free themselves to the point of knowing their chains and being able to resist them in incidents really critical to their spiritual growth. The evidence of this inability is observed in religious monasteries and in very active transcendental movements that either pick out one of the traps and rationalize it into deific status, justifying the trap as divinely imposed, such as marriage, or they carefully avoid identifying something as being a trap if it helps their business. It is hard to find in non-sectarian groups any harmony or even desire to work together because each is laboring under the rationalization of some trap or other. If we were all laboring under the same trap, then cooperation might be somewhat possible, as in a factory. But the different degrees of addiction become at first an interminable harping point and finally a mood of intolerance. So let us stop occasionally and think of the simple and yet profound effect of color. We find that colors bring certain moods to us, and we find that they do not always, as individual colors, bring the same mood to all people. That which elates one man may depress another. We are not only the unconscious victims of color, but of many other mood impellers. States of mind. States of mind are like massive gestalts. Psychologically, they have never been given the proper consideration. Most people are not aware of the existence of a state of mind other than one similar to their own. When they encounter another state of mind, they may reject it as aberrated or abnormal. Normality is always that which we are, not that which the other fellow is, and because of this lack of understanding, friction and even violence results. Psychologists try to create a sort of universal state of mind in regards to conduct and behavior. They have recently gone a step further and imposed sensitivity sessions upon some of the students of the country to force the precipitation of tensions and to bring about a homogeneity of reaction patterns. Psychologists and psychiatrists will fail again because they do not know all the factors, and specifically because they can at best be responsible for creating newer states of mind which shall conceal more deadly resentments than the possessor had before. Some of us are aware that we have different states of mind. However, most of us are unaware that many states of mind that exist among different people, nor are we aware of the tremendous role that these states of mind play in religion, politics, and war. Some states of mind are easy to see. For instance, similar states of mind are found in close families and among people of restricted social contact, such as the inmates of monasteries and prisons. Inmates of such institutions or families have several other states of mind besides the one which is common to all of the other members or inmates. Let us not confuse the term state of mind with mood. The mood is transitory and lacking in conviction and could be better explained as a state of perception, a clouded glass. We are lucky if we have only two or three states of mind. We are still more lucky if we know that they are there within us. A state of mind is invariably a fairly composite thinking pattern which has as its chief characteristic one of the basic desires of the individual in question. A more dominant state of mind may result from the synthesis of two or more desires and the synthesis of their corresponding philosophic rationalizations. It is easier to describe states of mind in the manner in which they are altered than it is to define them. We may take the case of two men, Mr. A and Mr. B, meeting at a bar. Mr. A uses a perfectly harmless word, penguin. Within a few minutes, and with little or no explanation, Mr. B has knocked him to the floor. Mr. A leaves, and within the hour is robbed by Mr. C, and finally, in another hour, Mr. A may encounter Mr. D and kill the latter when Mr. D places his hand in his pocket, thus reminding Mr. A of the robbery of an hour before. And yet 3 hours before, Mr. A may have been a benevolent extrovert. An analyst might ascribe the violent action of Mr. B to paranoid foundations, or might say that Mr. C was a robber because his mother tried to abort him. Paranoia is not a state of mind, but a singular example of a state of perception in which we can see the difference between the two, state of mind and the state of perception. With paranoia as a qualification of perception, or as a manner of looking at incoming impressions through Bruce sensitivities, there is no doubt that some of our states of mind will be affected, but not replaced. Any creature that has been repeatedly injured becomes paranoid. In Hubbard's Dianetics, such repeated injury leaves a mental scar which is called an engram. The scar or engram must be reckoned with in all future experiences related in any way to the experience that caused the engram or scar. If the being were not paranoid, it could be more easily killed or crippled as an individual and eliminated as a species. Paranoia says to the body, people are going to hurt you as they did before. You must adjust and train your personality to either frighten them or train yourself to be more aggressive. States of mind are various massive concept structures which usually come about over a period of years of evaluation and increasing conviction. However, it is important to remember that they can be brought about very quickly as a result of extreme physical or mental experience. The case of Mr. A is given to show roughly how this may happen. We take Mr. A and suppose he was a young ministerial student. He has led a rather sheltered life, but there have been times when he was insulted or in some manner afflicted for his gentle ways. His gentle ways were part of a passive state of mind, and his reactions to a life of mysticism helped form his passive attitude. And he may also have developed an additional tangential philosophy which saw God's will in his work and God's protection. The man who knocked him to the floor was a Catholic. Mr. B thought that Mr. A was poking ridicule at the Catholic nuns by his reference to the penguin, and Mr. B also thought that he was doing God's will. The violence suffered by Mr. A caused an abrupt change of mind. And when the threat of continued violence aids the paranoid element in his thinking, he feels quite justified in taking quick and violent action. The man subject to an abrupt change of mind state need not be timid. Strong, brave men have suddenly been reduced to tears, and bullies have suddenly become cowards under brutal treatment or in an incident of terror. Drugs inflict a similar sort of punishment upon the addict, but the metamorphosis is so subtle and gradual that only after the victim is hopelessly addicted will there be any intense suffering. It might be said that a traumatic experience or incident of intense suffering are about the only things that will actually bring about a change in the state of mind. The congestion of population has brought our attention to a sharper awareness of many different states of mind in different people, and the need to understand such states is also felt. Of course, understanding them is better than trying to alter them before understanding them. and understanding them in ourselves is of greater priority even in the search to understand others. I think that the study of states of mind is far more important than the focusing of attention on incidental reactions or behavior patterns. Such a study can come about only by direct experience, and the faculty for having direct experience can come about by particular systems of developing sensitivity or by a change in the being or nature of the observer that will facilitate his rapport with another mind. States of mind are not easily supplanted, and a person capable of switching quickly to an alternate or opposite states of mind could well be labeled schizophrenic. We are all schizoid to a degree, but not as obsessed as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We do have such obsessions, and they do change us for a period of time. We can examine the act of sexual intercourse and note that most people, if not all, have states of mind that vary or change with the act. The person who begins is not the same person who finishes. This has baffled people for ages. It can be blamed on abrupt chemical changes brought on by intense physical activity, endocrine influence, or it may be an automatic governor, which is part of the human structure to alter the pleasure drive once nature has attained its goal, so that the potential parent will not endanger his or her health in the pursuit of more pleasure, since nature is interested in the children. It is because the Sex Act has such a pronounced ability to change the state of mind that we find so many violent and bizarre murders connected with sex. Sometimes the partner who acts as a devastating catalyst is resented. Different ethnic groups have different states of mind, and there is no crime in this difference. The crime lays with the psychologist who thinks that he can banish it by denying it. The Negroes are aware of this wall of difference and protest. This is the admission of the knowledge of difference, that the whites do not think black. And, of course, the standard reply is that the blacks do not think white. It would be laborious, if not impossible, to go into all the factors that trigger conflict between states of mind. Some may be genetic and some may be acquired. For instance, the mouse has a state of mind quite different from that of the cat, and the cat's is different from that of the dog unless the cat is a lion. The cat has no respect for the mouse. There is no rapport. The mouse is geared for terror. It is numbed or hypnotized by terror and does not utilize any proper degree of resourcefulness when confronted by the cat. Perhaps, like the Christian martyrs, the mouse is also geared to enjoy his own immolation. The same occurs with people. Those who have been raised for generations to have a contempt for fear will also have a contempt for those whose chief feature is fear. Or an ethnic group that practices sex control may have difficulty in having rapport with another ethnic group that believes in no sexual restraints. The effects of these states of mind on political levels is not our concern here. We are concerned with those states of mind which stand like towers of Babel between religions, philosophical and transcendental minds. We only need to pick up some of the books that are being printed today on psychology, sociology, and theology to witness with amazement the many approaches to a common central point. If Aldous Huxley seemed to test our flexibility in reaching out for new understanding, he could not hold a candle to such artists of confusion as Brown and Rosack. And perhaps this writing will come to many as a hodgepodge of emptiness or a surfeiture of deliberate complexity. Let us examine the drug state of mind. If it is possible to find rapport with addicts without smoking from their pipe or drinking from their needle. Or let us observe the mental state of the alcoholic. Then let us begin to study religion. We may be attracted to a spiritual teacher who is hooked on drugs and despise the teacher who is addicted to alcohol. We may never know that the alcoholic had as much or more to offer, and what's more, we may wind up with an aura of injected needles instead of a halo. We can take a step further and presume that men of the four major paths, the fakir, the yogi, the monk, and the philosopher, have divested themselves of all obsessions, such as sex, drugs, or alcohol, and we will still be confounded by their distinct states of mind. The monk on a lesser level is a person who thinks he is fully evolved spiritually. His conviction marks his state of mind. He eats, works, and sleeps the part of the monk, and he finds peace of mind, which he identifies as God's hand. The fakir works on a lower level than the monk. He feels that he will find spirituality by controlling the body and its sensations. He does not understand the monk. The monk may understand him, but will be unable to get through to him long enough to convince the fakir in regards to the efficacy of a milder form of asceticism. The yogi occupies a rung above the monk, but the monk does not always understand him. The yogi understands the monk because he has transcended the way of the monk. He sees the monk wrapped in the confusion of sublimated sex and in the auto-hypnotic techniques which seem to be crude. The monk is begging the answer rather than seeking it. The Raj Yogi is looking for the true state of consciousness and is aware that others only think they have it. Still more free and advanced is the fourth way traveler. This is the sly man or the philosopher. It is apparent to those on the fourth step that they themselves, while they were on the lower rungs, could not comprehend or tolerate those who were later discovered to be on more advanced steps. And now, viewing those who, in turn, cannot tolerate them, the fourth way travelers are amazed that sincere, dynamic individuals dedicated to finding the truth can have so much lack of understanding and rapport. So that the thing to observe for each level is the level upon which you stand. The pursuit of truth necessarily involves the understanding of present states of mind first. Then there follows the automatic shedding of nonsense components of those states of mind, from which comes an evolution of mental purity, approaching all the while that state which is called Satori or cosmic consciousness. And by whatever name, we can be sure that it is the only true state of mind. It follows then that this writing is not intended to be an attempt to change human conduct except in the individual by the individual. We must first be aware that we are victims of our states of mind, not proud possessors of them. And we can be aware of them, to take a page from Uspensky, by self-observation. Self-observation, meditation, or self-remembering generally have an automatic self-correcting result. It is almost as though we were operating on a cybernetic law. The circuit is apt to clear itself once the trouble is located and admitted. Strangely enough, this automatic clearing of circuits through an application of energy inward may be the first realization for the individual of free will. This process involves the slave knowing the degree of his enslavement and utilizing mechanical processes to put an end to his present state of mechanicalness. When we embark upon a course of self-change in order to purify our consciousness, the first nice thing that happens to us is that we develop a new compassion for our fellow man and tolerance for his moody moments. We realize that he too is laboring beneath circumstances that are not of his making, and his states of mind have been imposed upon him by his environment and by his colored perception apparatus. But what is more important and more wonderful is that we realize we are at last on our way to becoming a vector of truth. We also learn that there are ways to change our dominant state of mind that do not involve the use of drugs. We find, if we look hard enough, that there are helpers or teachers, even if such are only books. There is somehow an urge within each man that wishes for him to be whole. The designer of our computers did not program us to be totally responsive to the hypnosis of nature. It is possible that we are, in fact, programmed to periodically resist any dominant state of mind so that we will be prevented from destroying ourselves in dissipation, thus destroying nature's most valuable herd in the process. This concept finds more meaning if we observe the innocence and conscience of children, and all of this implies that the designer of the computer had no other choice than to let us get a glimpse of those things which obsess us. To observe these states of mind, we need only to sit quietly and observe the present troubles that we have. It is best done when we are troubled, because then we have a high incentive impetus to use for energy. We should also do a little remembering and go back to the days when we were able to think more clearly, when our thinking bore convictions by which we risked our lives and our fortunes. Those convictions may have changed, but it is not appropriate that we look back on those years as being foolish just because we were young. We must remember the factors which made us think clearly then if we wish to think clearly today. And it is in this fashion that we must become as a little child. There can be no successful scientific study of psychology, nor can there be any promising individual search for truth without a better understanding of these phases called states of mind. Any attempt at analysis by viewing behavioral causes or environmental factors will only bring us to a knowledge of that which causes the state of mind, and then only if we absolutely know all the factors. These factors include all the things in our transcendental environment as well as the manifest environment. Most of us have awakened from a convincing nightmare or have recovered from a very hypnotic love affair. Some of us have been brutalized into accepting a state of mind common to our fellows, such as found in armies and penitentiaries. And we may have shaken our heads in amazement to think that our mind could be changed so easily. Yet the psychologists and psychiatrists have experienced this confusion of convictions too, or else the high rate of suicide among them would not exist. Men have had dreams that have shaken their lives. The augury of dreams, or the dreams themselves, have caused battles or wars. It is also true that transcendental phenomena has a great influence on states of mind. Hypnosis is no myth, and witchcraft has been used successfully against people who did not even know that a spell had been cast. We can only surmise that beings of another dimension, being strategically invisible and superior, may have profound effects upon us. If this is true, then the modern psychologists will have trouble finding compatibility with such evidence because they have agreed to believe that man is only a body and that transcendental experiences are really somatic maladies. So that when St. Paul was struck down on the road to Emmaus and endured for the rest of his life a profoundly altered state of mind, we are told by the psychologist through the lips of Huxley that Paul did, in reality, fall victim to an epileptic attack, possibly. We could go a step further into absurdity and say that Paul had just returned from visiting the local psychiatrist, the Witch of Ednor, who had just succeeded in purging him of his vile and homicidal syndrome. This explanation would prevent any shame for Christianity by showing that Paul was cured of his epilepsy and violence by the local witchcraft union. We like to think we are logical people living in an orderly manner. However, when we experience a change of state, all of our logic and all of our so-called professional and authoritarian attitudes is of no use to us. We find that we have been changed, and it disturbs us. Jung found it expedient to examine the Tibetan Book of the Dead, for therein is a hint that all that exists are states of mind. And unless the individual finds some stable manner to keep track of the true self in the many turbulent and often terrifying nightmares of life, what will happen to us hence when we can no longer flee back into the living body by simply awakening? I have only found two systems that I would recommend for studying the mind directly. One is the Gurdjieff-Uspensky system, and the other is Zen.